animals, so accurate and complete that modern-day botanists and zoologists have little difficulty in recognizing the species. Only rarely did Lewis use Latin-derived taxonomic botanical words, but his range of knowledge included at least 200 technical botanical terms in English. At Fort Clatsop, he discovered and described in great detail, often hundreds of words, 10 new plants and trees, including the magnificent Sitka spruce. He collected, labeled, and preserved to bring home to Jefferson dozens of plants, leaves, and cones. He demonstrated familiarity with their eastern counterparts by consistently comparing what he was seeing on the west coast with what he remembered from the east coast. Jefferson had ordered Lewis to observe the animals of the country generally, and especially those not known in the U.S. Lewis faithfully obeyed. During that winter, he wrote about some 100 animals altogether. 35 mammals, 50 birds, 10 reptiles and fish, and 5 invertebrates. Of these, 11 birds, 2 fish, and 11 mammals were new to science. In his classic study, Lewis and Clark, Pioneering Naturalists, Paul Russell Cutright points out that, though Lewis used a minimum of technical words in his description of new birds, he nevertheless supplied adequate data on color, shape of wings, number and length of tail feathers, color of iris, and note. Lewis also provided detailed descriptions of how things were done, ranging from Indian methods of preparing fish and roots to the making of canoes. On January 7th, when Drouillard brought in a fat beaver, most welcome as food, Lewis asked him how the castor or bait was prepared for the traps. He used over 500 words to describe the process as Drouillard explained it to him. You could prepare a castor and place it correctly on a trap today from Lewis's description. Some of Lewis's portraits were of animals he had encountered in the mountains, not native to the lower Columbia. For example, he wrote about Franklin's grouse, which, he said, he had not seen since leaving the mountains. This was another indication that he had not written in his journal while crossing the Nez Perce Trail. Jefferson has been criticized for not sending a trained naturalist on the expedition. Donald Jackson will have none of that. If a botanist, he asks, why not also a zoologist and perhaps a geologist? Later the government could send out such specialists. Now the problem was to get a few men to the Pacific and back, encumbered no more than necessary by equipment, and intelligent enough to recognize and collect, but not necessarily to evaluate, the natural resources of the region. Cutright goes further. Lewis was blessed with capabilities often missing in naturalists, particularly an outstanding inherent observational competence, an all-inclusive interest, and an objective, systematic, philosophical approach to understanding the natural world. Nothing refutes Lewis's self-appraisal as a botanist, and deprecating remarks of others more eloquently than his own abundant writing. In the context of the day, Lewis was an unusually capable naturalist, one with an attitude more consistent with scientists of the 20th century than with those of his own. While Lewis described birds, plants, animals, and methods, Clark worked on his map, covering the country from Fort Mandan to Fort Clatsop. On February 11th, he finished the work, an invaluable contribution to the world's knowledge. Together with his previous map of the lower Missouri, it brought the American West together for the first time. The map was Clark's work, but the implications of it were a subject of intense discussion between the captains. For 2 months, they talked about what they had seen for themselves and learned from the Indians. The result, in the opinion of geographer John Logan Allen, was the most important product of their winter on the Pacific. We now discover, Lewis wrote on February 14th, after 3 days of going over the completed map with Clark, that we have found the most practicable and navigable passage across the continent of North America. That note, almost triumphant, hid a deep disappointment. The real headline news from the Lewis and Clark expedition was that there was no all-water route across the continent. The short portage from the Missouri to the Columbia did not exist. This negation of the passage to India, Allen writes, the feature of all images of the American Northwest since Marquette, was the greatest single transformation of geographical lore for which the journey of Lewis and Clark was responsible. The best route fell far short of Jefferson's hopes. That was the answer Lewis was going to have to give to the first question Jefferson would ask when they met next year. Beyond his personal feelings, Jefferson would have to pay a political price. With the Sioux blocking the Missouri, and with no all-water route across the continent, the Federalists would have a peg upon which to ridicule the Louisiana Purchase. At Fort Clatsop, Lewis started practicing how he would present the news. That business about the best route made for a positive start. He went on to claim that, just as Jefferson had anticipated, the best route was up the Missouri and down the Columbia, the route the expedition had followed. Except for the two shortcuts from the Missouri, at the gates of the mountains and at the Great Falls, which the Shoshones and Nez Perce had told the captains about, these they intended to explore on the return trip. As for crossing the Bitterroot Mountains, Lewis explained that Indian information convinced him it would not be possible to go north or south to find a better passage than the Nez Perce Trail. He recorded without comment that it was a distance of 184 miles. Not much of a best route, but the reality of geography could not be wished away. In a little-known letter dated September 29, 1806, Lewis came a bit closer to recognizing that reality than he had in his Fort Clatsop entry. In it, he wrote that he had no hesitation to say and declare that the expedition had been completely successful in discovering the most practicable route, but then added the crucial qualifier, such as nature has permitted. For the men of the Enlightenment, there was no arguing with nature. Surely Jefferson would be unhappy with the end of his dream, but still glad to know the truth. And the truth was that Jefferson would have to put out of his mind forever any comparison between the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians. Sitting on his rough-hewn stool at his rough-hewn desk at Fort Clatsop, Lewis could imagine sitting in the drawing room at the President's house, reporting to Jefferson. He could imagine Jefferson taking in the news, nodding, accepting the fact, and already beginning to think of how to deal with the newly discovered reality. Lewis could suppose that, after getting some details, Jefferson might well ask about the commercial possibilities. Could Americans establish a trading post at the mouth of the Columbia and take over from the British the fabulously profitable fur trade with the Orient? Lewis was working on a plan to bring that about, but it had not yet matured. He revealed one part of it, however, by noting that the abundance and cheapness of horses among the natives on both sides of the mountains will be extremely advantageous to those who may hereafter attempt the fur trade to the East Indies by way of the Columbia River and the Pacific Ocean. The length and difficulty of the portage over that route could be overcome with readily available horses from tribes that had no contact with the British. He gave a census of the horse holdings of the Shoshone, the Nez Perce, and other tribes, all of whom enjoy the benefit of that docile, generous, and valuable animal, the horse. The British had to take their furs out the St. Lawrence and on to London before they could begin the voyage to the Indies. If only a man could figure out how to get a trading post established on the Columbia and a way to get the furs from the Canadian and the American Great Plains to it, American businessmen would have a one-year advantage over their British rivals. Lewis continued to think about that larger problem. But there would be no person-to-person report to Jefferson if Lewis did not get himself and his party home. He prepared accordingly. He checked the supplies, especially the rifles and ammunition. Now our only hope for subsistence and defense in a route of 4,000 miles through a country exclusively inhabited by savages. He found there was more than enough and congratulated himself on having come up with that happy expedient which I devised of securing the powder by means of the lead. The lead canisters had been through many adventures, but were little damaged. The powder was dry. Moccasins were being made. The rifles were all in order, thanks to John Shields's skills. Lewis had determined to stay at Fort Clatsop until April 1st, but on March 5th he indicated he wanted to move the date forward. For one thing, like everyone else, he wanted to get out of the place. For another, the elk were farther away than ever, making life even more difficult. By mid-March, Lewis had fixed March 20th as departure day. It came and went. The wind blew so violently the Americans dared not attempt the river in their canoes. Still, Lewis used the occasion to say goodbye to Fort Clatsop. His statement was objective and philosophical, and had just a bit of nostalgia to it. Although we have not fared sumptuously this winter at Fort Clatsop, we have lived quite as comfortably as we had any reason to expect we should, and have accomplished every object which induced our remaining at this place. In making the preparations for departure, Lewis set out to purchase a couple of native canoes to use in going up the river as far as the lowest falls. On March 14th, he bargained with a Clatsop over an indifferent canoe, but Lewis thought the price was more than our stock of merchandise would license us. I offered him my laced uniform coat, but he would not exchange. The expedition was desperately poor, almost broke. Two handkerchiefs would not contain all the small articles of merchandise which we possess, Lewis lamented on March 16th. The balance of the stock consists of 6 blue robes, 1 uniform artillerist's coat and hat, 5 robes made of our large flag, and a bit of ribbon. On this stock, he realized, we have wholly to depend for the purchase of horses and such portion of our subsistence from the Indians as it will be in our powers to obtain. Thinking it over, he added, a scant dependence indeed for a tour of the distance of that before us. But there wouldn't be any crossing of the mountains if the party couldn't get to the falls of the Columbia first, and to get there, Lewis needed Indian canoes. On March 17th, he sent Driard with his prized coat to pay the price demanded by the Indian owner of the canoe he wanted. He complained in his journal that the Indians valued their canoes too highly, and noted, I think the United States are indebted to me another uniform coat, for that of which I have disposed on this occasion was but little worn. His poverty and his great need for another canoe put him in a foul and desperate mood. He made a decision and came up with a rationalization to justify it. We yet want another canoe, and as the Clatsops will not sell us one at a price which we can afford to give, we will take one of them in lieu of the 6 elk which they stole from us in the winter. He did not point out that the Clatsops had paid for the stolen elk with dogs. On March 18th, the deed was done. Lewis did not record it, but Sergeant Ordway noted in his journal that 4 men went over to the prairie near the coast and took a canoe, as we are in want of it. When they got it back to the fort, they found that Chief Cobaway was visiting, so they hid it. Lewis admitted that the deception of Cobaway set a little awkward, but he covered his crime by giving the chief a certificate of his good conduct and the friendly intercourse which he has maintained with us during our residence at this place. James Rhonda rightly characterizes this as a particularly sordid tale of deception and friendship betrayed, at worst criminal and at best a terrible lapse of judgment, the essential honesty that distinguished Lewis and Clark from explorers like Hernando de Soto and Francisco Pizarro had been tarnished. Lewis felt he had no choice. Perhaps he was right. Perhaps the expedition's poverty did preclude purchase. Surely the Clatsops would have taken a rifle and some ammunition and powder for a canoe, but giving a rifle to a native would have involved a violation of an absolute rule, just as stealing a canoe did. Lewis chose to steal. During Cobaway's March 18th visit, Lewis had given him, with copies to other chiefs who visited that day, a list of the names of the men in the Corps of Discovery. He posted another copy in his quarters, explaining in a preamble that the object of this list is that through the medium of some civilized person who may see the same, it may be made known to the informed world that the party consisting of the persons named, and who were sent out by the government of the United States in May 1804 to explore the interior of the continent of North America, did penetrate the same to the Pacific Ocean. On the back of the lists, Clark added a sketched map of the Missouri and Columbia. Lewis felt that the chances that a copy of the journals would get from the Clatsops to a trading vessel and then on to Washington were too small to take the risk. Likewise, Jefferson's idea of sending 1 or 2 men home on a trading vessel with a copy of the journals and reports. Our party are also too small to think of leaving any of them to return to the United States by sea, Lewis wrote, particularly as we shall be necessarily divided into 3 or 4 parties on our return in order to accomplish the objects, exploration of alternative routes, we have in view. Anyway, it was highly unlikely that a trader who had to go around the world to reach the east coast of the United States could get there before the captains arrived. And there were no ships in the area. Leaving 2 men to wait on the chance that 1 would arrive soon was not practical. On March 22nd, the storm began to slack off, and the party prepared to push off in the morning. That day, Cobaway paid a parting visit. Lewis gave him our houses and furniture, a generous gesture, even if he had no other option. He wrote of Kabawe, in whose canoe he was about to depart, "He has been much more kind and hospitable to us than any other Indian in this neighborhood." Then came the last words he wrote during his long, wet winter at Fort Clatsop. Appropriately, they were botanical. "The leafing of the huckleberry reminds us of spring." Spring in Virginia, that is, where he intended to be when the leaves started to come out in 1807. Chapter 26. Jefferson and the West, 1804 to 1806. From the spring of 1804 until the summer of the following year, President Jefferson had no direct communication with Lewis. People of that era accepted such anxiety. Much as he wanted to know about the safety, progress, and discoveries of the expedition, there was nothing Jefferson could do. He could not issue any orders, provide any warnings, consult on any decisions. He could only wait and hope. In July 1804, Jefferson got his first return on the investment in the Corps of Discovery. A delegation of 14 Osage Indians from present-day Missouri, whom Lewis had convinced to make the journey in April, arrived in Washington. Captain Stoddard made the final arrangements. Horses, food, shelter, and soldiers for guides and security made it an expensive trip, but the often penny-pinching president considered it a good investment. "The truth is," he wrote Secretary of War Dearborn, "the Osages are the great nation south of the Missouri, their possession extending from thence to the Red River, as the Sioux are great north of that river. With these two powerful nations we must stand well, because in their quarter we are miserably weak." The representatives of the Osage Nation arrived on July 11th, which chanced to be the day of the Burr-Hamilton duel at Weehawken. The Osage men impressed Jefferson mightily. "They are the finest men we have ever seen." They were gigantic, he said, and noted with high approval that they were unused to spirituous liquor. He intended to win their loyalty through a combination of bribes and threats, the traditional American Indian policy. "We shall endeavor to impress them strongly, not only with our justice and liberality," he wrote, "but with our power." St. Louis businessman and friend of Lewis, Pierre Chouteau, accompanied the Osages as interpreter and general manager of the tour. Chouteau had his eye on the main chance. He met with Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, who sized him up thus: "He seems well disposed, but what he wants is power and money." He asked for a monopoly on the Indian trade west of the Mississippi. "I told him this was inadmissible, and his last demand was the exclusive trade with the Osages. As he may be either useful or dangerous, I gave no flat denial." Thus did the intense competition between frontier businessmen for the Indian trade continue under new management. The Chouteau family, along with Manuel Lisa, Joseph Robidoux, and others, were adept at currying favor with corrupt Spanish bureaucrats for precious trading licenses with the western tribes. And no wonder. It was the most immediate and by far the most profitable source of wealth in the trans-Mississippi West. There was a ritual to the Indians' visits. They were taken to the cities, Philadelphia, New York, Boston. Some cannon were fired for their edification, troops paraded, and then they called on the president. Jefferson's speech to the Osages, given in the president's house, was typical. "You have furs and peltries which we want," he said after announcing that he was their new father, "and we have useful things which you want." But a mutually beneficial commerce could not begin until the United States knew more about the Osages and their country. "For this purpose I sent a beloved man, Captain Lewis, one of my own household, to learn something of the people with whom we are now united, to let you know we were your friends, to invite you to come and see us, and to tell us how we can be useful to you." When Lewis returned, "We shall hear what he has seen and learnt, and proceed to establish trading houses where our red brethren shall think best, and to exchange commodities with them." Jefferson went on in a passage that is almost poetry. "It is so long since our forefathers came from beyond the great water that we have lost the memory of it, and seem to have grown out of this land as you have done. We are all now of one family, born in the same land, and bound to live as brothers, and the strangers from beyond the great water are gone from among us. The Great Spirit has given you strength and has given us strength, not that we might hurt one another, but to do each other all the good in our power. He concluded, "No wrong will ever be done you by our nation." 2 weeks later, and more than 1,000 miles west, Lewis made the same points in his speech to the Otoes, and persuaded Chief Little Thief, 2 other Otoes, 3 Pawnees, and a Missouri Indian to visit the president. In the fall of 1804, the Osages returned to St. Louis, thence on to their homes on the Osage River. According to Major James Brough, who had replaced Captain Stoddard as commandant of the newly created Department of Upper Louisiana, they were puffed up with ideas of their great superiority to other nations because of all the presents they had been given and the attention lavished on them. That same fall, Jefferson began to get garbled reports on Lewis's progress. On November 6th, he wrote Reuben Lewis, "I have the pleasure to inform you we have lately received through a channel meriting entire confidence advice that on the 4th of August he, Lewis, was at the mouth of the River Platte, 600 miles up the Missouri. 2 of his men had deserted from him." According to the informant, Lewis's plans were to send one of his boats and half the men back to St. Louis before winter set in. In the spring, he would leave half the remaining men with the Mandans to make corn for his return, and would proceed with the rest to cross the mountains and journey to the Pacific. That was sketchy and only about half true, but it was something. Jefferson, typically thoughtful, sent it on to Lewis's brother so that Reuben might inform his mother that her oldest son was safe so far. On November 5th, Major Brough passed on an even more garbled report that he got in St. Louis from some French trappers who had been on the Missouri River that summer. They told Brough that 2 of Lewis's boatmen deserted, that the others were much dissatisfied and complained of too rigid a discipline. I am not, however, disposed to give full credit to their story, as they report other unfavorable circumstances that cannot be true, such as a difference between the captains, etc. That was awfully thin, and we may suppose that Jefferson joined Brough in doubting the possibility of trouble between the captains, but it was the only news Jefferson was to get until the summer of 1805, following Corporal Worthington's arrival in St. Louis with the keelboat and the dispatch from there of the captain's reports, maps, and specimens to Washington. For practical purposes, Lewis and Clark were almost as out of touch with the civilized world as Columbus had been. Even parties of experienced soldiers sent out to find them couldn't. The search for Lewis came about because the commanding general of the U.S. Army was secretly a Spanish spy, codename Agent 13. General James Wilkinson, born in 1757, was a fabulous if despicable character. As an officer in the Revolution, he had entered into the Conway Cabal, a group trying to supplant General Washington, and from then until his death in 1825, he never met a conspiracy he didn't embrace. Charming, amoral, shrewd, a high risk-taker, and a survivor, he was a double agent. As Donald Jackson writes, "One never really knows at any given time whether Wilkinson is acting on behalf of the United States, Spain, or, as was often the case, his own arcane greed for power and money." He had betrayed Washington. He betrayed his superior, General Anthony Wayne, intriguing against him for his job. He betrayed George Rogers Clark, his rival for popular leadership in the West, spreading rumors and telling lies about him. He betrayed his country when he swore to Spain in 1787 that he would work for the secession of the Western states from the Union. He further betrayed his country in a March 1804 message to Madrid. At the time, he was in New Orleans. He reported that Lewis's expedition was about to depart from St. Louis to ascend the Missouri River, and that its objective was to cross to the Pacific. In New Orleans, the established French and the newly arrived Americans were making bets on how long it would be before the United States established a seaport on the Pacific. Wilkinson told Madrid the big money was saying 5 years. Madrid was full of fear that an avalanche of Americans was about to cross the Mississippi and begin to descend on their gold and silver mines. Wilkinson therefore touched a raw nerve when he reported on the Lewis expedition, and so he got an immediate response to his suggestion. An express ought immediately to be sent to the governor of Santa Fe, and another to the captain general of Chihuahua, in order that they may detach a sufficient body of chasseurs to intercept Captain Lewis and his party, who are on the Missouri River, and force them to retire or take them prisoners. Nemesio Salcedo, commandant general of the internal provinces of New Spain, with headquarters in Chihuahua, read Wilkinson's advice and tried to act on it. He feared that Captain Mary intended to penetrate the Missouri River in order to fulfill the commission which he has of making discoveries and observations. Those discoveries, he further feared, would be of gold and silver mines that were on Spanish territory. The only means which presents itself is to arrest Captain Meriwether and his party. The governor of New Mexico tried. Over the next 2 years, he dispatched at least 4 armed parties from Santa Fe to search for Lewis. He was realistic enough to write, "Even though I realize it is not an easy undertaking, chance might proportion things in such a way that it might be successful." None of the 4 parties had any luck. They didn't even come close enough for the Indian grapevine to pass on word to Lewis that the Spanish were looking for him. Like Jefferson, the Spanish were going to have to wait for Lewis to get back to St. Louis to learn what he had done and discovered. In the spring of 1805, in response to Lewis's entreaties the previous summer, Oto chiefs and warriors, as well as Indians from other tribes living along the Missouri, began descending on St. Louis. They wanted that grand tour at government expense Lewis had promised them. General Wilkinson, in St. Louis, about to assume the governorship of Louisiana Territory, complained to Secretary Dearborn. There were too many Indians, it was too expensive to send them to Washington, and the lines of authority were unclear. Wilkinson charged that there had been a collision between Lewis, Stoddard, Brough, and Chouteau. Lewis, he said, had given Stoddard authority to make all the arrangements for Indian delegations to proceed to Washington with a blank check to draw on the War Department. But Brough claimed the sole right to issue passports, and Mr. Chouteau has contended for the entire control in all Indian relations. Wilkinson believed out that such conflicts produce pernicious animosities and disgrace the public service, and by confounding authorities destroy all responsibility. He asked Dearborn to put one man in command. Later, he complained that Indians kept coming to St. Louis demanding their free trip to Washington and lots of presents. He held the delegates through the summer on the grounds that it was too hot for them to travel. Costs for keeping them happy in St. Louis were escalating, as were expenses for the tour. He had to pay $1,500 for horses, because these personages will not walk on an embassy to their father. Some of this he would recover for the government by selling the horses in Louisville, where he intended putting the Indians on a boat to Wheeling, making them march to Pittsburgh, then putting them on a stage to Washington. Stoddard would be in charge of the tour. Wilkinson ordered him to see to the comfort and accommodation of our red brethren, but held him strictly accountable to an expense allowance. "Every unnecessary expense should be carefully avoided. You must guard against tavern rates, by the purchase of your provision or by encamping and cooking, and by every other means in your power." Sleeping on the ground certainly saved the government money, and the event showed that Wilkinson was realistic about how much it would cost to feed the Indians at taverns. Stoddard later reported that these hardy travelers consumed nearly 12 pounds of beef a day during the journey, each. Jefferson didn't mind the expense of courting the Indians. As he later explained to Congress, good relations with the tribes on the Missouri were indispensable to the policy of governing those Indians by commerce rather than by arms, and the cost of the former was much less than the cost of the latter. Lewis was the advance agent of Jefferson's Indian policy. He was able to do exactly what Jefferson wanted because he knew Jefferson's thinking so well. In his dealings with the Missouri River tribes, Lewis had represented the American government. He had announced that Jefferson was the new father of the red children, had served as mediator to establish peace, had warned the natives of the power of the United States, had promised that American trading posts would soon be set up in their country, had offered them steady jobs and a secure income if they would go to work instead of war, take furs rather than scalps. If the policy succeeded, commerce would rule in Upper Louisiana. Happy red warriors would dance around the campfire with their good friends, the white agents, Guns and other manufactured goods would come up the Missouri. Prime furs would float down to St. Louis. The policy Lewis was establishing represented, in Jefferson's thinking, only a first phase. Jefferson knew that such a system of commerce could not last long. For one thing, the beaver east of the Rocky Mountains were not a renewable resource. The whole history of the fur trade in North America was one of overtrapping the beaver and moving west. There is an exact parallel with the Virginia planters who grew tobacco for 3 years and then moved west. For another, immigration and emigration, the most important factors in shaping the United States, precluded leaving Louisiana to its current inhabitants. Americans, whether U.S. citizens or recent immigrants, would push west. No power on earth could stop them, certainly not the feeble U.S. Army or the distant government. In the process of moving through Indiana, Illinois, Tennessee, and Kentucky, these emigrants and immigrants would push the natives westward. In the immediate future, Jefferson proposed to deal with that problem in three ways. As he put it in February 1803 in a directive to Governor William Henry Harrison of Indiana Territory, he first proposed to remove the white population of Upper Louisiana across to the east side of the river, giving them equal or larger holdings, and forbid emigrants access to Upper Louisiana. Second, he hoped to civilize at least some of the Indians living east of the Mississippi. Third, those Indians who remained uncivilized could be sent west of the river into what would be a vast reservation. Jefferson told Harrison his hope was that the Indians would incorporate with us as citizens of the United States, or, failing this, remove beyond the Mississippi. From the government's perspective, that made perfect sense. The frontier would move forward at a regular pace, but only after the Indians had been civilized or removed. Pioneers would have to purchase regular deeds and titles to the land they farmed, rather than just squatting on it. Frontier clashes between red and white men would be reduced, if not eliminated. There would be law and order, bureaucratic regularity, taxes collected, and a reduced need for the U.S. Army. But it was all a pipe dream. As well try to stop an avalanche as to stop the moving frontier. American immigrants and emigrants wanted their share of land. Free land. A farm in the family. The dream of European peasants for hundreds of years. The New World's great gift to the old. Moving west with the tide were the hucksters, the lawyers, merchants, and other men on the make looking for the main chance, men who could manufacture a land warrant in the wink of an eye. This had been the experience in Virginia, and it was currently being acted out in Indiana Territory. And within a year of the day Lewis and Clark set out up the Missouri River on their expedition, it was taking place in Upper Louisiana. Wilkinson had his orders to block any movement into Upper Louisiana, but, as he told Secretary Dearborn, "No opposition can be given to the bands of migrants who are crossing the Mississippi, because almost the whole country is covered by grants, real or fictitious, and it would be hazardous in a public office to remove a settler until the merits of the title under which he squats is ascertained." He had no clerks or officials to conduct such examinations of the titles. His situation was impossible. It was an experience he shared with every frontier governor in American history. Jefferson was as responsible for this mad rush west as any man. He had purchased Louisiana. He had sent out his beloved man, Lewis, to explore and publicize it. He had printed and widely distributed the captain's glowing descriptions of the land along the lower Missouri. He was thus encouraging what he said he wanted to restrain. Hypocrisy ran through his Indian policy, as it did through the policies of his predecessors and successors. "Join us or get out of the way," the American said to the Indians, but in fact the Indians could do neither. By pushing them ever west, the Americans made it impossible for the Indians to become civilized, as they meant the term, and it turned out there was almost no place where the Indians would be out of the way of the onrushing pioneers. Jefferson said he believed the Indian was almost as capable as the European, and although not ready for assimilation, soon would be. In contrast, blacks would never be ready. In this, he differed from other presidents, yet only in theory, not in action. In fact, he stole all the land he could from Indians east of the Mississippi while preparing those west of the river for the same fate, after the beaver were trapped out. How could the greatest champion of human rights in American history do such a thing? Jefferson and his contemporaries would not have regarded the question as valid. In their view, Indian ideas about land ownership were a lot of foolishness. A band of Sauks rode twice a year through a territory as big as an eastern state and claimed it as their own. That land could support thousands of farms, tens of thousands of settlers. Anyway, no matter how much compassion Jefferson felt toward the Indians, however badly he wanted law and order and bureaucratic regularity on the frontier, on this question the people, not the government, ruled. Americans had but one Indian policy, get out of the way or get killed, and it was non-negotiable. The only thing that separated Jefferson from the settlers was that he wanted to buy the Indians out rather than drive them out. But that, too, was more rhetoric than reality. He wrote Harrison that the policy was to exchange lands which they, the Indians, have to spare and we want for necessaries which we have to spare and they want. Trading posts should be established among them, and the agents should extend credit. Soon the Indians would run into debt. When their debts mounted, they become willing to lop them off by a cession of lands. Jefferson concluded, "In the whole course of this, it is essential to cultivate their love. As to their fear, we presume that our strength and their weakness is now so visible that they must see we have only to shut our hand to crush them. Keep the peace. Civilize the tribes, trade with them, and get title to their lands." As Donald Jackson comments, "These ends could be accomplished by fair or foul means, and fair was better, especially if it cost less. The Indians can be kept in order only by commerce or war," Jefferson said. "The former is the cheapest." However cynical Jefferson's long-term policy, his short-term decision to establish an American trading empire on the Missouri was eminently practical, if the Sioux could be brought into it. "The immediate payoff on the Louisiana Purchase," he wrote Dearborn, "was that it gave us a perfect title and thus strengthens our means of retaining exclusive commerce with the Indians on the western side of the Mississippi. In other words, we can kick the British out of one of their most profitable markets, certainly something that would give the author of the Declaration of Independence satisfaction. As a bonus, it would be profitable to the United States and its citizens, and begin the process of extending American power to the Pacific." Jefferson's Indian policy, with which Lewis would be associated all his adult life as advance agent, was subsidiary to his overall Western policy, with which Lewis was also associated as advance agent. That policy was to make the United States into a continental power stretching from sea to sea. The first step was to find the Northwest Passage, if it existed, and in the process map and describe Upper Louisiana. The next steps were to map and describe the other parts of the Louisiana Purchase, which meant sending similar expeditions up the southern tributaries of the Mississippi and up the Mississippi itself to discover its sources. Government-sponsored explorations could only feed the frenzy of the frontiersmen, but that was a price Jefferson was willing, eager, to pay. As Lewis and Clark were preparing to shove off from Wood River in the spring of 1804, Jefferson was setting up other expeditions. One was designed to go up the Arkansas River to the mountains, march to the headwaters of the Red River, and ascend it back to the Mississippi. Another was to find the sources of the Mississippi. A third would explore the Ouachita. None was completely successful. The one going up the Red River was turned back by the Spanish. The one going up the Mississippi failed to find the source, as did the one going up the Ouachita. They all got started in 1806, after Lewis and Clark had reached the Pacific. Their failure illustrates how lucky, how good, and how well led the Corps of Discovery had been. Jefferson's first goal was good maps. He wanted to know what he had bought. He explained his purpose to naturalist William Dunbar. "The work we are now doing is, I trust, done for posterity, in such a way that they need not repeat it. We shall delineate with correctness the great arteries of this great country. Those who come after us will extend the ramifications as they become acquainted with them, and fill up the canvas we begin." That the maps thus produced, once published and distributed, would encourage more westward movement was a risk Jefferson was willing to take. That the westward movement might someday bring American settlers to the Pacific coast was another risk he accepted. Indeed, it was his policy. Through the winter of 1805-6, Lewis was thinking of ways it could be implemented. In May 1805, as Wilkinson was making the arrangements for the Indian delegations to go to Washington, Corporal Worthington brought the expedition's keelboat into St. Louis. News moved fastest by the newspapers, which copied articles from one another. On June 24th, via that route, Jefferson got word of the keelboat's arrival and some information on the expedition. "We have just heard from Captain Lewis," he wrote his daughter, "who wintered 1,600 miles up the Missouri. All well." He expected to soon receive reports, maps, and specimens. That was all the news he had. Jefferson added that 45 chiefs from 6 different nations are forwarded by him to St. Louis on their way to this place. Because of the agonizing slowness of the mails, it wasn't until 3 weeks later that Jefferson learned that documents and boxes were on their way from St. Louis, the documents by land and the boxes via New Orleans. He was also told to expect a letter from Lewis by the next mail. The next mail, however, wouldn't come for nearly 2 weeks. Jefferson postponed his annual trip to Monticello from July 15th to July 17th to wait for the Western mail to come in. Jefferson was philosophical about the delay. On July 10th, 1805, he wrote Reuben Lewis, "It is probable they are coming on by a special messenger who travels slow." He enclosed a newspaper account of the progress of the expedition to the Mandans. 3 days later, Jefferson received the documents, including Lewis's letter of April 7, 1805, Clark's journal covering the period May 1804 to March 1805, Clark's map of the lower Missouri, and an invoice from Lewis listing the items coming in boxes from New Orleans. Jefferson biographer Dumas Malone notes that the invoice from Lewis could not have failed to arouse the eager anticipation of such an enthusiast for natural history as Jefferson. It listed animal skins, horns, and skeletons, specimens of plants and minerals, cages holding 4 live magpies, a prairie dog, and a grouse. It was August before the boxes arrived in Washington. Jefferson was in Monticello. He sent instructions to have the furs dried and brushed and then done up in strong linen. The grouse and 3 of the magpies were dead, all killed by the survivor. Jefferson ordered that special care be given the remaining magpie and the prairie dog so that he might see them on his return to the Capitol. On October 4th, Jefferson got back to the president's house, where he reveled in the specimens from the Trans-Mississippi. He sent some to the American Philosophical Society, some to Charles Wilson Peale for his museum in Philadelphia, some seeds to his botanist friends, and kept some articles for his Indian Hall at Monticello, where some horns and Indian artifacts are on display today. He entered into a long correspondence with his fellow naturalists about the discoveries, which, Malone writes, gave him greater satisfaction than he gained from politics. But politics was his business, and the political payoff of the expedition was not curious animals and plants, but maps and solid information about the Trans-Mississippi Indians. These were contained in Clark's map of the Missouri and Lewis's statistical report on the tribes. The map would later be superseded by the much more accurate one Clark made at Fort Clatsop, but it was a great step forward in geographical knowledge. Lewis's statistical view of the Plains Indians, running to some 60 printed pages, provided a description of the tribes, their location, population, and activities, along with his glowing account of the fur trade and other commercial possibilities. Together, the map and report surpassed both in scope and reliability anything hitherto available to the American government on the American West. By themselves, they justified the expense of the expedition. With considerable pride, Jefferson reported to the Congress on the achievements to date and ordered the map and the statistical view to be printed and distributed as a part of his annual message. They were the first printed fruit of the expedition. There was an impatient audience for them. Publishers in Washington, New York, Natchez, and London printed editions in book form. In his message of transmittal of the Lewis and Clark documents to Congress, Jefferson mentioned the command structure of the expedition, the only time he did so. He reported that Captain Meriwether Lewis of the 1st Regiment of Infantry was appointed with a party of men to explore the river Missouri from its mouth to its source, and crossing the highlands by the shortest portage to seek the best water communication thence to the Pacific Ocean, and Lieutenant Clark was appointed second in command. As far as the president was concerned, it was the Lewis expedition. In October 1805, Stoddard's tour left St. Louis, including 45 Indians from 11 tribes. They arrived in Washington in January 1806. Jefferson gave them the standard Great Father talk. "We are become as numerous as the leaves of the trees, and though we do not boast, we do not fear any nation. My children, we are strong, we are numerous as the stars in the heavens, and we are all gunmen." He followed the threat with the carrot. If they would be at peace with one another and trade with the Americans, they could be happy. In reply, one of the chiefs said he was glad the Americans were as numerous as the stars in the skies, and powerful as well. So much the better, in fact, for that meant the government should be strong enough to keep white squatters off Indian lands. How much good these tours did for Jefferson's Indian policy is questionable. Surely the visitors were impressed, but they had their own constituencies at home, who were not likely to embrace the program no matter what tales the returning warriors told about American power. Further, as almost always happened when trans-Mississippi Indians traveled to Washington, a number of the chiefs died from diseases picked up along the way, which created considerable resentment and mistrust back in the villages. The Indian delegates brought with them grapevine news of Lewis's progress. On January 12, 1806, Jefferson wrote William Dunbar, "We have no certain information of Captain Lewis since he left Fort Mandan, but we have, through Indians, an account of his having entered on the passage over the high lands dividing the Missouri from the waters of the Pacific." The next day, he wrote Reuben Lewis that he had a letter from Pierre Chouteau in St. Louis informing him that two Otoes had said that Captain Lewis and his party had reached that part of the Missouri near the mountains where the Indian tract, road, leads across in 8 days' march to the Columbia, that he had there procured horses and had, with his whole party, entered on the tract. He did not expect to hear from Lewis again until he returned to St. Louis, but, "knowing the anxiety of a mother in such a case, I mention this information, praying you to present her my respects." Although his original orders gave Lewis permission to return by sea if it was possible and if he thought it best, obviously Jefferson expected the expedition to return overland. Why he was so certain is unclear. In 1805, he informed various sea captains headed around the Horn and on to the mouth of the Columbia of Lewis's possible presence there. Lewis and Clark hoped to find a trading vessel to replenish their supplies, but never did. Jefferson has been severely criticized by historians Bernard DeVoto and David Lavender and editor Elliot Coues, among others, for failing to send a U.S. Navy vessel to pick up the explorers. The criticism ignores some fundamental factors. In 1805, the Navy was fighting a war in the Mediterranean against the Tripoli pirates. It had half its strength stationed there. 6 frigates, 4 brigs, 2 schooners, 1 sloop, 2 bomb vessels, and 16 gunboats, or under orders to go there. All the remainder of the fleet was laid up for repairs and refitting. There were no vessels to send. Even had there been, Jefferson couldn't be sure the expedition had reached the mouth of the Columbia, or would still be there when a ship showed up. Indefinite at best, since it could take from 1 to 3 weeks to round the Horn, depending on the winds. Arlen Large's conclusion seems inescapable. Jefferson's non-action seems justified by so many what-ifs. The president could only wait, hope, conjecture. In February 1806, he told a correspondent that he guessed Lewis has reached the Pacific and is now wintering on the head of the Missouri and will be here next autumn. He was right about the first point, wrong about the second. Whether he had gotten the third point right or not remained to be seen. It depended on the captains. Chapter 27. Return to the Nez Perce. March 23 to June 9, 1806. "At 1 p.m. we bid a final adieu to Fort Clatsop," Lewis wrote in his journal the night of March 23. The party had hardly proceeded a mile before it met a Chinook band of 20 or so. The chief said he had heard the expedition wanted to buy a canoe. He had brought with him an elegant one he wished to sell. But, Lewis wrote, whether with satisfaction or shame, Being already supplied, we did not purchase it. The next day, an Indian guided them among some islands, then claimed the stolen canoe as his. Lewis offered him a dressed elk skin for it. Surrounded by 32 riflemen in 5 canoes, and without a clear title in his possession, the Indian accepted. Maybe this payment assuaged Lewis's conscience. It didn't alter his act. The theft of the canoe showed how desperate he was. As the party set out from Fort Clatsop, it caught a much less impressive figure than it had on April 7, 1805, as it set out from Fort Mandan. In 1805, the canoes were jammed with boxes, canisters, kettles, bales of trade goods, blankets, tobacco, whiskey, flour, salt pork, corn, dried squash and beans, writing desks, tents, scientific instruments, tools of many descriptions, knives, rifles, and more. In 1806, the party set out with canisters of powder, scientific instruments, kettles, dried fish and roots, the clothes on their backs, and rifles. They were only halfway through their journey, but they had spent 95% of their budget. On the other hand, in 1805, they didn't know what was ahead. In 1806, they did know, and they had put supplies into caches stretching from the Nez Perce country to Great Falls, so they would be able to replenish as they moved east. Knowing the lay of the land ahead was a mixed blessing, however, for part of that land was the Bitterroots. From the moment the men left Fort Clatsop, the rigors of those mountains were on their minds. "That wretched portion of our journey," Lewis called it in his June 2nd journal entry, "the Rocky Mountain, where hunger and cold in their most rigorous forms assail the wearied traveler. Not any of us have yet forgotten our sufferings in those mountains in September last, and I think it probable we never shall." Going up the Columbia was hard work. The current was always strong. In rapids, the canoes had to be towed. Falls had to be portaged. Food was a constant problem, as were the multitudes of curious Indians. On April 1st, Lewis learned from some natives along the Columbia that there was a great scarcity of food on the river, that the people upstream were starving, and that the salmon run wouldn't begin for a month. "This news gave us much uneasiness," Lewis wrote. In the country above the Dalles, through the plains to the Nez Perce camps at the base of the mountains, there were no deer, pronghorns, or elk. Lewis conferred with Clark. They agreed that to wait for the salmon would keep them from getting onto and down the Missouri River before it froze. Delay would also cost their horse herd, being held by Twisted Hair, because he had told them the Nez Perce would cross the mountains at the beginning of May, and without Nez Perce's help, Lewis doubted the men could round up the expedition's horses. On April 2nd, the captains decided, not surprisingly, to lose as little time as possible in getting to the Chopunish village. Chopunish was the captain's name for the Nez Perce. They would stay below the Dalles long enough for the hunters to kill and dry sufficient meat to sustain them until they reached the Nez Perce. Lewis figured that the party could live on horse meat as it crossed the Bitterroots. He explained, "We now view the horses as our only certain resource for food, nor do we look forward to it with any detestation or horror, so soon as the mind which is occupied with any interesting object reconciled to its situation." But there were no horses below the Dalles. There were dogs, which were purchased whenever possible and were a favorite food of nearly all the party. On the 3rd, Indians descending the river in search of food paid a visit. "These poor people appeared to be almost starved," Lewis noted. "They picked up the bone and little pieces of refuse meat which had been thrown away by the party." Clark was off on a side expedition, probing the Willamette River, some 10 miles upstream to the site of the present-day city of Portland. Lewis supervised the preparation of the jerky for the trip over the plains. Never one to waste time, while the men kept the fires going under the strips of elk and deer, he looked for and described new plants and animals. "I took a walk today of 3 miles," he wrote on April 8th, "in the course of which I had an opportunity to correct an error which I have heretofore made with respect to the shrub I have hitherto called the large-leafed thorn." He was referring to the salmon berry, which he had confused with the thimble berry. He made amends for his error with a remarkably detailed description of the salmon berry, including an attempt to classify it using the Linnaean system. On the human side, he had Indians to deal with. They came in from the small villages up and down the river to see and steal from the white men. These people are constantly hanging about us, Lewis complained on April 6th. I detected one of them in stealing a piece of lead, he wrote the next day. Back in Virginia, a plantation owner would have a slave whipped for petty theft, and perhaps Lewis felt the impulse to do just that, but these were Chinookan Indians with whom he wanted good relations. Instead of beating the thief, I sent him from camp. But he also inspected the rifles and held a target practice in front of a group of Indians, who shortly departed for their village. The following night, April 8th, the sentinel detected an old man trying to sneak into the expedition's campsite. The soldier threatened the intruder with his rifle and gave the fellow a few stripes with a switch and sent him off. As with Lewis, tempers were running high among the men. Never before had they whipped an Indian. But never before had they been so provoked. One party of warriors tried to wrest a tomahawk from Private John Coulter, but they had picked the wrong man. He retained it, Lewis dryly recorded. Still, as the expedition worked its way upriver, whether dragging the canoes through the rapids or portaging them, the Indians were always there, ready to grab anything left unguarded for an instant. At the Cascades, on April 11th, Lewis had to detail guard parties to watch the baggage because, "These are the greatest thieves and scoundrels we have met with. One of them had the insolence to cast stones down the bank at two of the men." Others threatened Shields, who had to pull his knife to drive them off. In the evening, three Indians stole Lewis's dog, Seaman, which sent him into a rage. He called three men and snapped out orders to follow and find those thieves, and, if they made the least resistance or difficulty in surrendering the dog, to fire on them. The soldiers set out. When the thieves realized they were being pursued, they let Seaman go and fled. Lewis may have been ready to kill to get Seaman back, but the Indians weren't ready to die for the dog. Back at camp, meanwhile, an Indian stole an axe, got caught, and after a tussle gave it up and fled. Lewis told a group hanging out at the camp that, "If they made any further attempts to steal our property or insulted our men, we should put them to instant death." Lewis and his men were right up to the edge of serious violence. They had no patience left, and the temptation to use their rifles was very strong, especially since they felt surrounded. "I am convinced that no other consideration but our number at this moment protects us," Lewis wrote. He and the party were in so foul a mood that they could entertain the thought of a first strike. One quick volley would drive the Indians away. But that was dangerous thinking. Giving in to temper would be risking not just good relations with the natives, but the expedition itself. Lewis had to keep a check on himself without allowing the Indians to pilfer the pantry of the expedition or run off with his dog. He controlled his breathing and began talking, through the sign language, with the chief. The chief responded to Lewis's charges about Indian behavior by laying all the trouble at the feet of two bad men in his nation. They alone had been responsible for these scenes of outrage of which we complained. The village as a whole wished for peace and good relations. So did Lewis, who concluded his account, "I hope that the friendly interposition of this chief may prevent our being compelled to use some violence with these people. Our men seem well disposed to kill a few of them." Of course, some young warriors in the Indian village were equally well disposed to kill a few of the whites. Knowing that, and determined to prevent it, Lewis recorded, "We keep ourselves perfectly on our guard." The captains decided that once they got onto the open plain country above the Dalles, they would go overland to the mountains. To do that, they needed as many horses as they could purchase. Clark went ahead beyond the Dalles to set up an advance camp and begin buying horses. Lewis stayed behind to oversee the portage of the baggage. After the first day of haggling, Clark sent a runner to tell Lewis the Indians would not sell at the price being offered. Lewis sent back a note telling Clark to double the price. He wanted at least 5 horses and wanted them badly, for he wanted to get out of there to shake these Indians from his heels. In addition, the longer the expedition stayed in the area, the more chances the Indians would have to execute any hostile design should they meditate any against us. The Indians knew a seller's market when they saw one. They kept saying no to whatever Clark offered, which in truth wasn't much. What made it so maddening was that the natives beyond the Dalles, as Lewis complained on April 17th, have a great abundance of horses but will not dispose of them. On April 18th and 19th, Lewis broke down and paid the price of 2 large kettles for 4 horses. Never before had he been willing to part with a kettle. The expedition was reduced to 4 small kettles to do its cooking, 1 per mess. The night of the 19th, Lewis directed the horses be hobbled and allowed to graze, with orders that the man who was responsible for each horse stay with him and watch him. But Private Willard was negligent in his attention to his horse and suffered it to ramble off. Lewis's temper again flared, this time at one of his men. This, in addition to the other difficulties under which I labored, was truly provoking, he explained in his journal. I reprimanded Willard more severely for this piece of negligence than had been usual with me. As Lewis and the men with him made their way up the Columbia, the Indians continued to torment them. Tomahawks and knives disappeared during the night. On April 20th, Lewis had once again to warn the local inhabitants that if I caught them attempting to purloin any article from us, I would beat them severely. That remonstrance had to be repeated at every village. When the party got above the Dalles, Lewis decided to abandon the canoes. Getting them past Cilillo Falls appeared to be impossible. Join Clark at his upriver camp, obtain as many pack horses as possible, and march to the mountains. That decision made, on April 21st, Lewis had all the spare poles and paddles placed on the canoes. Then he set fire to the pile. He was determined to make certain that not a particle should be left for the benefit of the Indians. While the fire burned, Lewis caught an Indian stealing an iron socket that had been tossed aside from one of the poles. His pent-up fury burst forth. He caught the man, cursed him, beat him severely, and then made the men kick him out of camp. His blood was hot. He informed the Indians standing around that I would shoot the first of them that attempted to steal an article from us, that we were not afraid to fight them, that I had it in my power at that moment to kill them all and set fire to their houses. The release that came with the physical satisfaction of beating the thief and the psychological pleasure of shouting threats at the young hangabouts who were gawking at him drained some of Lewis's emotion. He breathed deeply and got control of his temper. He told the Indians, "It was not my wish to treat them with severity, provided